back to another edition of Mormon Expression. I'm your host, John Larson. And today we've gathered another all-star panel to place before the king. First of all, to my left is the wonderful and vivacious Zilpha. Hi, Zilpha.
Hello, John. Hello, everybody.
Welcome back.
Thank you.
So it's been a little while. In the meantime, Zilpha, what have we been doing?
We've been busy.
And we, for those who don't know, we have another podcast that we record weekly called the Reasonability Podcast.
Yeah, we've been busy with that.
You can check us out over there. We don't talk about Mormonism.
Yet.
Kinda. But we do a little bit. Around the table, also joining us from the Board of Directors of Sunstone, and from the Mormon Expositor podcast, the effervescent Greg. Hey, Greg.
Hello. Happy to be back.
Welcome back to Studio Fist in Your Face.
I'm super excited to be here.
It's dusty in here.
Well, you know, we're going to dust it off.
And also joining us, another guest star from the Feminist Mormon Housewives podcast. Well, I brought in like the cream of the podcasting crop today, right? Lindsay. Hey, Lindsay.
Hello. Happy to be here. It's an honor and a privilege to be with you fine people today.
The honor is ours indeed. And you are a new mother.
I am.
This is your third?
7 weeks postpartum.
Your seventh?
A new mother again.
If I were a good Mormon wife, it would be my seventh, but it's only my third and my last.
7 weeks. Is that... I mean,
well, she's smiling.
I am a man. Yes. I don't. Is that?
Yes, I am lactating, John. Is that where you're?
No, I just don't know what that means. Is that is the baby in or out? That's more my question.
The baby's out. The baby's good. She's sleeping good, and we are happy.
Excellent. All right. Well, welcome. Today we have another interesting topic. At least in my mind, it's one that I know Zilpha and we've talked about for a long time doing, and it actually brought us out of retirement to cover it. We have talked quite a bit in the past year, so I went run down the podcast about problems in the church. That is yours, my friend.
It's not. It's Brent's.
Oh, is that one that's supposed to? I know it's supposed to go one way or the other. I thought it was Brent who gave it to give it to you.
No, he left it at our house.
Oh, so I'm supposed to give it to Brent?
Yes, I think I gave it to Brent here at your house. But anyway, we'll just leave that alone.
I thought Brent gave it to me to give to you.
We got the passing back and forth of sex toys. Yeah.
No, that'll all be cut out.
Okay.
Sex toy? I thought it was like drug paraphernalia.
It's a capo. It's a guitar capo.
It's a guitar thing.
So,
no, not nearly.
So Zilpha, we've talked quite a bit about...
coming to terms with misogyny
in the church. Right. In the church. And misogyny, of course, is defined as sort of the systematic hatred of women. And it's used as an umbrella term to talk about things that are sort of tilted against women, or where the culture or the attitudes or the pay scale or what people are allowed to do is sort of anti-female or puts a bias against women. And we've talked about that in terms of children on the podcast. We've talked about it in terms of women and in terms of the priesthood and many things in the church. And it's such an obvious example of, you know, if I was going to list the top three or four things that show that the church is sort of a harmful organization, you know, that would definitely be on the top of the list. It's a harmful organization for women. It treats women like a second class citizen. Yeah, I think we've put that out there and that's acknowledged. The problem's not over with. I don't mean to trivialize that problem. But I think there is another insidious problem that's in the church and that tends to run a little bit under the radar. And that is the same sort of attitudes. It's technically called misandry to follow the same paradigm as misogyny, where you have the same sort of hatred or dislike or problems that you impose on men. And so that's our topic for today. We're going to talk about how the church mistreats men.
You guys have it so rough.
Well, we're going to see how
case in point, the sarcasm comes out already.
So I think I have a question at the very outset, which is you make it case that the I think you can make a very easy case that the church mistreats women.
It's pretty easy to see that. We'd all agree with that.
I think it's also pretty easy to make the case that the church mistreats men. And so who does the church not mistreat? Because maybe because we're making a gender specific dichotomy there in terms of like misandry or misogyny is creating a dichotomy that is gender specific. Maybe the dichotomy should be more like the church mistreats its adherents as opposed to its leaders, or I don't know what is.
I think even the leaders are in a tough spot.
You have an interesting point, but I don't think there's a balance act that if it's mistreating one group, that necessarily means another group is advantaged.
No, that's fair. That's a fair point.
Can I speak to that?
That's there's a new word,
ooh,
a new term that you can look up. It's called the hierarchy. So we have a patriarchy, and so we assume that men are at an advantage over women in a patriarchy, right? But the hierarchy takes into account race, sex, class, your sexual orientation, if you're able-bodied or not. And so the patriarchy does not benefit all men, or I would say that not all men can take full advantage of the benefits of a patriarchy.
Well, and I think you're exactly right on. That's one of the points I want to make is we tend to look at the advantage that the church gives to some men. But if you do the math, and they say, well, men are bishops, men control the priesthood, men have this, that, and the other. But that is always a minority of men who enjoy those trappings of power. And so what I think the first false dichotomy that happens, and it's partly because most of the benefits or the things that are given to the women tend to be more egalitarian. Like we doctrinally talk about that the gift of being able to give birth, the gift of motherhood is a divine sort of thing, and it's something that the women have.
Not all women have that.
Absolutely. But we tend to fetishize that. Not all women have, but the minority women don't. It'd be like a biological concern. But when we talk about like priesthood leadership, not all men there's sort of like token leadership positions, you know, like I hate to tell everybody this, but the teacher's quorum president really doesn't exercise any power.
Right. No, that's right. I mean, those two relationships are inversely related, right? Priesthood leadership is as the inverse of motherhood.
Yes. But it's not enjoyed that way. And,
right.
And real power, the patriarchy, if we talk about the patriarchy, like where power is exercised, is concentrated in the hands of a few.
Well, and
actually, the further you go up the ladder, you will find that just like all governments and all organizations, that power is concentrated in the hands of few families also. It's not, I mean, the church has been out in South America and in Europe and in all these places since almost
years.
The get-go, and you will see that those other groups are not represented. So if we're taking this dichotomy, the dichotomy is not so clear because it's a smaller group of people that wield power. Why are there not more Hispanics? There's none in the Quorum of the 12. There's very few in the Quorum of the 70. Most of them are in the second Quorum of the 70, where their power is automatically limited by,
right,
you know,
but
in terms.
All men have power, or they're supposed to exercise authority in their family. They're supposed to preside in their family.
Absolutely.
Well, if you're okay, let's look at the men in power in the Mormon church. White, usually American, westernized men, mm-hmm. for sure. Usually wealthy. So they're all men. They're all straight, as far as we know. They're all white and English speaking for the most part. We have two now that are from different countries. Is that correct? Or
right.
Just one.
And there's always, and actually that, that's
Uchtdorf.
That's
it's
gone right. down.
In the actual. Just the one.
Okay,
just Uchtdorf.
Just the one.
Just the one shining
Germany.
Star.
So if you're a man of color, if you're a black, disabled, overweight, homosexual,
you can still
have the priesthood. So that puts you at an advantage in the patriarchy over a woman. But you're never going to make it in the Quorum of the 12 with all those strikes against you. But if you're
probably
a Latin
not even
man.
A bishop.
Good point. Especially being a homosexual.
Well, this same thing that you're talking about shows up in economic politics. That when you look at the breakdown, like in American politics, between conservatism and liberalism, that conservatives are usually interested in this idea of upward mobility and protection of wealth. But when you look at actual wealthy people, I mean, people who control real wealth in the United States, they tend not to have those views. The people who have those views tend to be squarely middle class. And if you work in a company, you'll see the same thing. The people who are most devoted to corporate structures and toadyism are not the people at the top. It's the people who hope
to be there.
To hope
it's
to be
the
there.
The future rich.
Right.
It's the, I think I'm going to be rich someday, so I better vote that way now.
Mm-hmm. But organizations understand the concept of a glass ceiling and dangling fruit in front of people. And one of the things that I think, Lindsay, you're pointing to is there is no hope for women, really, in the current structure of the church to rise to those power structures. But for every man, even though it's naive and it's not really there, it's potentially there.
But I have to say something about that because – I think men and women are in the same position in the church in that they don't have a choice as to whether or not they want to be in charge of their family, of their ward, of their stake.
Correct.
They don't have a choice. There's no choice involved.
Yeah, you can't aspire or you can't like work to get to, well, I guess you could, but technically you can't work to become a bishop or a stake president.
No, and what if you don't want to be a bishop and yet you get pushed into that position?
Yeah, I think that that's the important thing. Because this feels like a weird conversation. It feels like a weird conversation.
Wait till we start talking about sex. Then
that feels
weird.
Like a normal conversation. This feels like a weird conversation from the perspective of a believing member of the church who explicitly does not aspire to priesthood responsibility. That almost seems like its own piece, like the hierarchy of the church, the power hierarchy of the church, how that happens, whether aspiration to power makes any sense or has any relevance in that, and the dynastic nature of it. That feels like that's a different thing than the patriarchy that exists at the normal level,
at the
Larson, Greg Rockwell level. That we were saddled with when we were 22
married, or whatever. Might,
yeah,
that might be have
or
more...
does it? I think. I mean, the patriarchy. Where you guys in the ward level? Let's break it down to the ward level.
You guys meaning men?
No, I mean all of us.
Oh, okay.
Sorry, I as a woman here, I should give a disclaimer that we're talking about male issues, and I'm a female, so I'm just acknowledging my privilege as a woman. So in a ward level, you have leadership, the bishop that we all look up to. You have male leaders that you all look up to. What female leaders did you look up to?
As a male
growing up.
Really just the primary chorister.
No, I agree. But
that's a disadvantage.
So when we talk about the power structure, you can absolutely break it down into the ward level. Of course, we use different terms and we don't think about it in such a systemic sort of way, but it doesn't mean that it doesn't absolutely color everything that we do.
And the root of this whole thing is that men can have the priesthood, women can't. And that means there's something either special, there's something special about men that they would need the priesthood or they would get the priesthood.
Something special or...
Or something not special.
Right.
Something special too.
I mean, there's something different about men.
Right. So let's talk about that. I want to briefly mention, you know, for people who might not think about the power, you know, because I think you can look and say, you're talking about a power of a bishop, talking about a power of the stake president, and then you look at the church handbook construction, say, well, they're told everything to do. Mormon church all follows a script that's reproduced everywhere. Say, what power are you talking about that they exercise? The power that they exercise is over people's personal lives. In Mormonism, especially when it deals with sexual issues or issues of conflict, you talk to any bishop or any stake president, and they spend the majority of their time in marital counseling. Mm-hmm. And sexual counseling.
Yeah, they're basically a therapist.
When the doors are closed, they're talking to people about very personal issues. And bishops and stake presidents have an extreme amount of influence in the personal lives of those who live in those stakes and those wards. And that goes for both men and women. You know, women talk about having to be submitting themselves to men, which is true, and it's uncomfortable, and it is a male-female dynamic. But the men themselves have to do the same thing. Zilpha, you brought up the point of view that the man in our culture is seen as the patriarch or leader of the home, mm-hmm. and he's in charge of the home. But he has to submit himself to the bishop, and the bishops can and do and will go in and intervene in issues between a husband and a wife. So it's true that the women across the board are submitting themselves to this patriarch, the structure. But since, you know, as we talked about, the patriarchy is in the hands of a small group of people, you know, literally like 1 in 100 men, you know, for the bishop, or 1 in 300, and then moving up the scale. So the men themselves are submitting in this same aspect. They're submitting to other men. So there's a hierarchy that men have to find themselves in that is not egalitarian at all. So the man who goes to church every Sunday, especially as he ages, is constantly reminded of the fact that he is not the spiritual leader, that there are others who are spiritually above him. And I want to talk a little bit about the priesthood, what Zilpha just hinted at. So in this sort of paradigm, this doctrinal paradigm, we have, of Mormonism, we have this constant battle between evil and good. And if you look in the scriptures, we pointed this out from a misogynistic point of view, women are left out. But really, in the doctrine, women are, in essence, bystanders in this battle between good and evil. Women are the mothers, and they're sort of the Virgin Marys. They are like out of the narrative. They're protected. They're holy. They just sit the whole thing out. Right? They're on the sidelines.
Because doing evil is so complicated when you can be baking cookies instead.
Exactly. So when you see in the scriptures the battle between good and evil happen, it always happens in male terminology. And if you look at, especially like, I'll give you a very stark example. The early church leaders, the Brigham Young and his generation, not only believed in polygamy, but they believed in a multitude of wives. And you can find writings where they talk about hundreds and hundreds of wives. What this means for the afterlife, or for the way things are in the universe, is that heaven will literally be populated, not just like 2-to-1 female to male. I mean, hundreds and hundreds and hundreds. The men, and this is the heart of what I'm trying to get to in a long-winded way. Men need the priesthood because men are irredeemably evil and incapable without it. So your bishop, your stake president leads and is a patriarch because he has this external gift, not because, oh, Brother Hansen is a really spiritual man, a really great leader. Brother Hansen has been given this gift. And men, culturally and doctrinally, without the priesthood, are seen basically as animals.
What did you say, Zilpha? You were talking about the scripture earlier.
The natural man is an enemy to God. It's talking about men, not women.
I would say it is. Absolutely.
And it's funny because in my active days, in that phase, I took such umbrage at the concept that men had the priesthood because they were less spiritual than women. And I did essentially the very beginning of our marriage, that, like, you know, you get to the, you're married and you are going to elders quorum and people are talking about that, this is, you know, women are so much better than men, and that's why we have the priesthood, and so that we can sort of come up to their level. And it's not that I thought that the opposite was true. Mm-hmm. I just thought, this just can't be right. It struck me as wrong from day one, but I never was quite able to make sense of it. I think it's interesting the way you put it almost systematically that way.
But also, Greg, that's the only way it would make sense to have polygamy in the afterlife, in heaven, if women were naturally more righteous than men.
You're saying because there are that many extra women.
Yeah, extra
women.
Well,
see, the economics of heaven are never really all that.
You mean they might be fembots?
Clearly, like, made.
But that's,
you know,
how it would make sense, right? Like, everybody, I think, in the church sort of has the idea that women are basically more righteous than men are.
Yeah, can I read a quote from James E. Faust that I found
Please.
On this? And it kind of incorporates this doublespeak that we hear, that, like, men are these brutish animals. So he's talking about fatherhood, and he says, "Let every mother understand that if she does anything to diminish her children's father or the father's image in the eyes of the children, it may injure and do irreparable damage to the self-worth and personal security of the children themselves. How infinitely more productive and satisfying it is for a woman to build up her husband rather than tear him down." So that's good, right? He said, don't tear down your husband. And then he says, "You women are so superior to men in so many ways that you demean yourselves by belittling masculinity and manhood." So it puts men in this double bind, and women in this double bind of, you know, don't belittle men, but they are less than you.
Yeah. Well,
so.
And implied in that whole quote is that men are Plato. And you'll see this. Men throughout, if you look at the manuals, you look at the way men are approached in teaching, there is this constant derision of men and their capacity to do anything throughout the culture. And it happens. You see the example of the Relief Society and the doilies and all this kind of stuff. The women can take care of this and they prepare lessons.
The preparation
and they do all this
level.
But if you look at the chapel building, I know I brought this up before, and the women have a room. They have closets. They have a budget. I have never seen in all the years I went to church a budget set aside to buy things like doilies. Women have that.
Flower arrangements.
So from the baseline structure, it is set up that that's the only way it can be.
That men can't.
And how many jokes do we hear at the ward level of, oh, the man just has his manual up in front, ha ha ha, and the woman has her ice sculpture.
Right.
But we follow that script.
I would say that's not just a script, though. That pragmatically is the way most wards function. And I think the way that the place where you see it function the most that way is in young men and young women, and the level of preparation. And, well, the boys are playing basketball again, and the girls are doing some really well planned thing, and the women leaders are boiling. Over the lack of preparation
it
of
is,
the
but
men.
I don't want to use my anecdotal experience, but in my experience, the men, the youth leaders I had, which were generally good, the men prepared just as much as the women did. And I'm sure there are men who don't. I'm sure that there are women who don't. But there is this narrative of this is what happens. And I mean, let's go back to our Relief Society one. The women are not as divided. Like the elders' quorum usually meets on like the stage or in some corner. The churches do not even put a room. There is not a priesthood
room
for
the elders,
for the elders or the Melchizedek priesthood. So there's strike one. Strike two is the men are divided out. Like the bishopric is pulled out of the quorums because the men have to serve in all these different positions that women have no access to. They are collectively like the strength of the quorum is diminished right from the get-go. Hmm. You know, there's clerks and there's finance people and there's all these other positions that are being filled, and they're all pulling out of that same pool. And then you divide the men right there in half. You put the younger ones here and the high priest there. So that sort of deck is stacked right there between that successful coalition, that women can sometimes achieve, that group dynamic of saying we're all sisters working together. The men, they're all divided out and they can't even get to that point.
Does this have to do with I'm just going to throw this out there, overcompensation for the fact that of the charge of women being less equal than men? I mean, like, we're not less equal. We give the young women a room. We give the Relief Society a room.
It could be, yeah.
And the men don't have it.
Right.
And this is the issue with patriarchy. I call it the backside of patriarchy. Anytime you have a system that benefits an oppressed people or someone over an oppressed people, men over women, the men are going to suffer too when you're not in the top position. That's why I think it does apply to the ward level. And we're going to, you know, flesh all that out. But the power system is very important to recognize because there's a certain amount of, there's a certain list of characteristics that you have to be in the church to be successful, to receive the full benefits of the patriarchy, which we've talked about. And if you don't, sometimes you're going to get hurt more than women. Because in our church, we're already trying to overcompensate by saying, look, we're equal. So, you know, we raise women up and we tell them how great they are. And so if you're not in one of those, you know, you don't meet those characteristics of what a man should be in the white shirts, you know, the masculine white shirt, strong priesthood holder, then,
And you're tall and fairly good looking and white.
Yeah, then there's so many things that can happen to you.
Well, I think you see this in corporations, you see this in the military. There's a sink or swim aspect. Like, let's say you're running a boxing club, right? Down on the 42nd Street. You know, as a boxing trainer, you can only take two or three kids or young men up to the ring. Like, so if you, to use another sports analogy, if you go join the football team has 90 guys on it. But it's not because they need 90 guys. They need 45 guys that they can have the other guys run into. So if you're on third string, you're the brute squad. You're just there to have the other guys plow into you. So when you need fewer men, like anthropologically, every culture needs more women to be successfully generate the next generation than they do men. And men are always going off to war. Men are fodder in that sense because we do not need as many men successfully. So part of it might be that there's a sink or swim thing to have a good functioning community award that's going to take care of the next generation. You need more women than you need men, sort of, because you, and this is because of the structure they have,
Brigham Young was right all along. It's all about more women and one man. one man.
Potentially, but it doesn't. It's not inherited that way. But it's not like in the fabric of the universe. But that's the way it's been structured. That's the way it's been set up. So a man who can rise above the mediocrity of elders' quorum to display spirituality has already selected himself out as being, you know, somebody who is likely to be able to serve in those positions that are lonely. When you're a bishop, you don't have a lot of support. When you're stake president, you have to make decisions on your own.
Well, I think we should talk maybe about some more specifics that have a huge impact on men. And the first one, when I put this out to the Mormon Expression VIP lounge, that came up was mission. There's a huge pressure. Basically, you don't have a choice. And it's a huge commitment. It's psychologically difficult and often psychologically damaging for men who go on missions. Mm-hmm. If you don't go on a mission, you are not equal with the guys who did.
That's
and
true.
You limit your prospects for marriage.
Also true.
Yep.
So I want to say one of the things I recently realized that I've been thinking about regarding a mission was that prior to my mission, I was invested in my Mormonism, but I came back fully indoctrinated. Prior to my mission, I was in an environment and culture in high school and everything where I had a lot of friends who were gay, where I had a lot of friends who were not Mormon, and where I really validated that we were actually hanging out with a high school friend this last week, and I asked her, was I like a jerk, or was I, and maybe she was just being nice, but she said, no, I didn't feel like you were ever judging me. But coming home, getting married, being in a very, being in that, in a job where I was in California, but I was in a job where I was mostly working with LDS people, and my social life was mostly also with LDS people. My level of indoctrination, my political views, everything about that was so much more heavily brainwashed coming away from my mission than going into it. And I thought that, and realizing that has been really an interesting thing.
But all the investment.
Oh, sorry.
Is huge. 2 years is a long time, especially between 19 and 21. And it takes a lot of sacrifice. So when you do something that you put so much of your life into, it's hard to say, oh, well, that was just a mistake and I wasted my life.
I read a study on terrorism once, and they were saying that, you know, the extreme Islamic terrorists recruit young men usually at the age between 19 and 21. And there's a reason for that because, you know, with brain development and those kind of things, human beings are really eager at that stage because they're in that transition to adulthood in our society. So their minds are more,
palatable.
Pliable, like sponges. And there's a lot of reasons why, older terrorists recruit younger terrorists. And I hate to call missionaries terrorists. That's not, the correlation that I'm drawing here, but I am saying that the church does recruit young 19-year-old boys for a reason. And I've often heard it said at church, well, you know, they get out of high school and they drift and that's when they're at their sexual peak. So we got to kind of rein them in because if not, they're going to become these wicked hooligans.
Well, the military does exactly the same thing. And I've read other things that suggest not about terrorism, but talk about that in terms of sexual angst. A 21-year-old might be somewhat at his sexual peak, although that's, but has a lot of sexual energy and not a lot of sexual opportunity. Right. The older men get, the more likely they're to have sexual opportunity.
Well, maybe for you, but
so. What happens is as men age, then they get in families and they're more fulfilled. But yeah, they're using that angst that's driven by testosterone and whatever else going on, and they're funneling that.
It shows up the level to which, especially men, young men can't be trusted, how much they are required to be with someone all the time. They are not supposed to be alone except to go pee.
Absolutely. And let's dig into what happens on a mission. The first thing you're taken away is your name, right? You no longer can use, because in our culture, we really don't use, the only time people use last name are like when they want to strip your identity away. Mm-hmm. When you're on a football team, they use your last name. When you join the military, they use your last name. When you join when you become missionary, they use your last name. You have to dress the same. You have to get rid of all of your haircuts. You have to get rid of all the individual trappings. And what you are learning, what that mission is, because it's not a very effective way to do what they're trying to do. Anybody can come up with 10 more effective ways to get people
members.
In the church. What they're doing is they're doing the same thing that happens in boot camp. They're stripping away the individual identity. They're teaching you file obedience to leader. They're teaching you, you are nothing without the priesthood. You are nothing without obedience to your leaders.
And you can't be trusted on your own.
And you can't, yeah, that's the message that's constantly given to men. Men are not without the priesthood. Men are animals. Men without the priesthood can't do anything. And the priesthood is always intertwined with obedience and control. It always is.
Well, it says right in the Doctrine and Covenants that, you know, if you stray or you stop being righteous, your priesthood is, it's the amen to the priesthood of that man.
There's all these powers that are enumerated with having the priesthood, but almost all of them cannot be exercised without approval from your file leader, mm-hmm. right? So you're given this thing saying, oh, you have this wonderful thing here you can do, but you can't even go baptize your own kid. Right. Right. Without getting permission. And they'll tell you when and where you can do it. They'll probably tell you who you have very little control
in the usage of that. Father's blessings and
right, right. There are a couple of little things.
But then there's pressure there because it's not a script that you're supposed to be the conduit for God's words.
But it doesn't have any real power in the
church. Right.
Yeah.
In the church, it doesn't really. Right. It's safe.
Right.
But there's pressure that men feel to be this spiritual giant and this thing that can speak the words of God. And a lot of men feel like they're either pretending or they just don't feel that way. They don't feel like they're getting that kind of inspiration.
Well, I'll speak to that. I remember my grandpa used to give me father's blessings because my dad was inactive. And when he would do it, I felt like a seminary video. Like you could hear like music in the background and the room got quiet and there's this electricity. And I was like, that's the priesthood, baby. And then I got married and my husband, who hates this kind of stuff, would give me a blessing. And I'd be like, really? That's all you got? You know what I mean? And there was that pressure. There was that attitude even imposed on me to think like, if it's the priesthood, why isn't he being more articulate? Mm-hmm. Like, what's going on here?
Yeah, like, where are God's words?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Well, there's something about this. I think that this kind of conversation about what we expect of men sort of in the church, that's actually probably where I feel like the damage of patriarchy comes in a lot. In both the way that you expect these social primates to sort of rise above their normalness and get very articulate and very, very well spoken and have all of this wisdom to offer. But also in similar ways, you're saying to them, have as many kids as you can. As soon as you can. And make sure that your wife never has to go to work for a day in her life. And that there's a subtle, a subtle message of if you asked your wife to go to work, that's a failure. If you have that conversation, if any of that happens, then you're a failure. And so men are left facing the prospect that they just have to figure out a way to make it work. And
right.
Really making it work is hard.
Yeah. There was a comment on the VIP lounge thread that was pretty demonstrative of this. He said, my brother is in a tough situation where he has been laid off and his wife refuses to work. My brother will take odd jobs like carpet cleaning, Radio Shack, etc. But my sister-in-law refuses to work. When asked about doing her part, she says, in our church, we believe men are supposed to be the breadwinners. If he has to work 3, 4, or 5 jobs to support me, he'll do it. I'm not taking a job. That's not how it works.
Right. And the pressure that, you know, anybody who's worked, you know, more than just like a job, they don't, any sort of career, you know, man or woman or whatever, knows that there's a huge amount of pressure there to compete and to be viable and to be successful. And you'll have performance goals put on you and performance reviews. And for men in the church, there is also this underlying, you are to provide and provide for your family, and your family should get bigger and bigger, and you should provide for your wife and your family and all that kind of stuff. And there is another element of comparison between you and everybody else, because your primary role is to be the priest, the patriarch, the spiritual leader, and then to be the material provider. These things are both difficult things to do. And on the spiritual side, you know, Lindsay, when you're talking, I thought it's funny. I don't think you can find a female in the church who got married who wasn't disappointed in the spiritual level of her husband. Because oftentimes we
expect them to be like a prophet.
We would be raised, yeah, with these men like up Moses. On pedestals, literally. I mean, yeah. They're up on the stand, you know, they're in their red chairs and stuff. And then you marry somebody, and oftentimes they're just a human being, and you're expecting this spirituality out of them that's I think most men and women both get over it and realize, well, that's unrealistic, and maybe I don't care that much anyway.
But some women never get over it.
But yeah.
And they can never fully appreciate their spouse because of that aspect.
But not only are these pressures there on this economic success, but if you look at the lessons, being a provider and stuff, they're almost framed in a way that's unachievable, that guarantees to keep sort of the self-esteem of men in relationship to the church constantly damaged, constantly down. The church's message is that men are not successful that way, you know.
Well, believers need to get real out there and admit and be honest with themselves that there is absolutely a culture or an expectation or a status given to men of leadership in the ward. Like, every woman at some point in her life has considered the fact her husband might be a bishop, uh-huh. Right? Mm-hmm. Every man has considered at some point what it would be like if he was bishop. And now we're trained to say, oh, I wouldn't want that. That's so much responsibility. I'm just the Lord's humble servant. We're absolutely trained in that way. In fact, I was talking to someone who was dating a mechanic at the time. Great guy. They actually are married now and they've made a lot of money, and they're very successful. But when she was dating him, her brother said, he's a mechanic, really? How do you ever expect him to be a general authority? I mean, right. At least the guy owned to it.
Wow.
It's absolutely in our culture that men are expected to
make money.
To make money and to be in a bishop someday. Or a stake president.
Well, and part of righteousness, or showing that you're righteous, or God showing that you're righteous, is that you have a bunch of money.
It's also that, yes, exactly to that point, it's also that we believe in an interventionist God. So we believe that your rectitude will be manifest by these outward signs. Your righteousness will be manifest by the degree to which you are able to provide for your family without a hitch, and that will be manifest to your wife. So even though she's in the internal conversation, the conversation is still not real with her, where she has expectations about what it means to be married to you. And if you are a good man, then we shouldn't be having this conversation about why we can't pay the bills.
Well, I'm just going to give you a failed test case for anyone that believes in that. Heber C. Kimball. He had how many wives? 34 plus?
50 plus.
Couldn't provide for most of them. So even though everything's supposed to work out, the more wives you have, it's supposed to, you know, it's all going to work out. Heber C. Kimball's wives lived in poverty. So
I'm related to one of Heber C. Kimball's widows, or a widow that he married. And not only did he not, he didn't provide for her at all. I mean, like, he completely ignored her. She was married to him, but he felt no obligation to it whatsoever.
Yeah, and so we have, like, to Greg's point, I think we have so many women that do have that expectation. And I've heard, even within my own family, it'll all work out. I know we cannot provide for we cannot afford to have a child right now, but
yeah,
it'll work out.
President Monson just last year said, talking about these young men who seem to not want to get married, and he's trying to figure out why it could be. And one of the things he said was, maybe you're concerned about providing financially for a wife and a family. He said, let me assure you, there's no shame in a couple having to scrimp and save.
But there is shame. And the
You'll
shame
get will- closer together during those hard times.
Maybe. But the shame will be borne by the men, right? And it will be borne openly. Everyone will know, and it'll be obvious. And you know, what's funny is when we're praying to heal somebody, we will usually almost always use a weasel word, you know, if it be thy will, or if it, you know, that, or whatever's best.
According to your faith.
But we get up because when money's at stake, we talk openly about God intervening. If you pay your tithing first, you will be able to, you'll be able to make ends meet. And we all know that's bullshit. But the way that happens is, yeah, you'll meet, especially in young wards, it's not uncommon to have several men who are working multiple jobs and stuff, because there is no magic. There is no magic that if you give 10% to this corporation in Salt Lake, that suddenly your finances work out.
When you don't have that 10% extra.
And it will drive people down. And I have seen culturally, that where women, I've seen this more from, this is me, from seeing it more from women than men, where they'll get up and they'll publicly talk about, you know, these sort of things, where men tend to keep that stuff like quiet. If they're having financial struggles, a woman would get up and sack me and talk about, we're having such financial struggles. My husband, he got recently he got a demotion at work and da da da. And, you know, and meanwhile, you can just watch the testosterone just run out of that poor guy right there in the third row.
Cause that's his inherent spiritual duty as a provider.
Right. And the thing, I guess I listened to some of the rhetoric in, like in, I don't know whether to call it feminist rhetoric or what, but I listened to the rhetoric of saying like, well, women need to be able to choose. Women need to be able to choose whether they want to be at home or whether they want to like work or not. And a part of me just wants to say, no, they don't get to choose. They just need to plan on working. working is part of life. And if you choose to have children, that's fine. And then you can figure that out. And consequently, I'm an apostate. So, I mean, you know, but this idea that women get to choose either this or this, men don't ever get that choice.
And it is debilitating. Both men and women should be able to choose.
I agree. We just did a podcast with stay-at-home dads, and they said, you know, if they stay at home because their wife makes more than them or because they wanted to, they always have to explain it to someone. It's like, well, I stay at home, but I've got a job in the work, or I'm working from home. You can never just say, I stay at home.
Was it Hinckley? I think that actually in a talk shamed that. He said, he was talking about education and talking about women getting more education. He said, would you want your wife to be able to make more money than you? Something of that effect.
I found so many talks on LDS.org in ways to motivate men. There are several titles like Be Man, or you can Google them. But his motivation was, women are more educated and they're graduating with more degrees. Are you guys going to let the women step, you know,
take your place? Let those girls over and over.
Yeah, that's how he motivated it in several different ways. Women are going to church more. Are you going to let that happen, men? You know?
Well, yeah. And back in the 60s and 70s, they would tell women, don't go to work because otherwise you'll demasculate your man and he won't respect you. And
heaven forbid we have men acting like women.
And once again, you know,
or women acting like
in that exactly. rhetoric is always this implication that men are dumb animals that have to be manipulated into doing things. Mm-hmm. You'll find this over and over again.
You come home, no matter how hard your day was, you give a smile to your man because he probably had a hard day too. But it's the woman who is supposed to make the man feel better. Like, the man is so weak and so volatile that you have to,
you know what popular book is popular in female relief society book clubs? The proper care and feeding of husbands.
Oh, yes.
Or the proper care and feeding of pigs, or the proper care and feeding of cats, horses.
The interesting implication in all that, that thing saying, your husband has likely had a hard day, greet him with a smile, is that men are so emotionally retarded.
That they can't do that the same for you.
That they couldn't tell the difference, right? That a man is so inept with social things that he cannot tell when you're just doing things just to manipulate in one direction or the other.
Or that he can't handle, just like you can handle hearing about his hard day, that he couldn't handle hearing about your hard day.
I think part of that also, and this gets away from the topic at hand, but it gets into the inauthenticity of Mormon relationships and how they're taught. It gets away it gets to the point that we believe in having a relationship on script, that we don't believe in really opening up to each other and
being vulnerable.
Two people
communing.
Two people actually living together. And so the script of, or what I noticed in my faithful life. So we would come home from church every week, essentially, and I would go, oh, I'm so happy to be married to you. Like, Letty heard that so many times. And it was sort of, in some ways, she pointed out to me that it was a little bit misogynistic, because what I was also saying was, I am so happy to not be married to those crazy bitches in our ward. Uh-huh. But what it also spoke to was the way that I would see couples live sort of these parallel, disconnected lives where they would kind of shoot across the bow at each other in these weird ways that I just thought, what sounds fun about that? I'd rather be divorced than be like living the way that you people live. But that relationship on script and that relationship of like sort of making sure that you're adhering to your role more than you're being together is very much, I think, the way that Mormonism teaches marriage and teaches relationships.
It's because it cripples men into being emotionally illiterate. because when we have these things that are men are supposed to strive for, they're like masculine identities, uh-huh. right? They're be the strong, stoic priesthood leader. Now, of course, the church is a little bit different, and we do allow men to cry over the pulpit. I guess
in a very scripted, very specific way.
Sensitive as a man in the church.
Sensitive spiritually yes. to the because yes. it's implied in the leadership chain, right? Our bishop is supposed to have this conduit to heaven.
So men have this mixture of having to rely on their emotions and yet being the strong.
No, I disagree a little bit. I'd say they're not supposed to rely on their emotions.
Right.
It's the spirit.
But I'm saying coming from an atheistic perspective, they are relying and they're taught to rely on their emotions, and yet those are not their emotions. Those are.
But yeah, the inside spirit is there's this vessel. This man is sitting here, and he's not giving you any marital advice. He's telling you what the God Lord is whispering in his ear. Yeah.
Even if it contradicts what the guy in the next office down the hall is saying to another couple.
Totally.
Oh, so I want to dig into this. We're talking about, that everybody has these scripts they're fulfilling, and we don't have normal relationships. And, you know, on a side note, that I've met a lot of couples, and I'll see some couples that really get along great. And then as I get to know them, I'm waiting for one of two things to happen. I'm either going to find out if they really get along peachily. Either I'm going to see a blow up, which is good, which is a relief. Like, I'm going to see a conflict. Not necessarily like blow up, but there's going to be conflict that's going to manifest itself. Then I'm like, oof, good, they got a normal, healthy relationship. Because two dynamic people are going to disagree about a hell of a lot of stuff. Or I'm going to find out that one of them's a doormat. And if you see couples getting along well, there's one of two things. That they're not getting along well all the time, or one of them is, or both of them are doormats. But usually they're both doormats, you're not going to meet them because they're home. So let's go into the meat and potatoes of them getting along with sex.
Meat and potato sex?
Well, we've all wanted to talk about this whole time, but we've been skirting around.
Yeah, it's called foreplay. Great. And I know they don't teach it in those.
They don't.
Oh, we forgot to mention we have an audience here today.
we do. We have a fabulous, beautiful audience.
Five people.
All right. Let's go through a little thought experiment. You're at a party or you're reading something online, and it talks about this young married woman, and she goes for her first. She goes for her first time into a sex shop and buys a little vibrator and brings it home and pleasures herself.
And isn't that sweet?
Isn't that cute? I mean, everybody.
What are you reading about online, John? Jeez.
This is an example.
So what I'm saying is most people. This is hypothetical. Most people will look at that. If a woman admit. Now, I'm not talking about sacramentally. I'm talking about generally culturally, or even, you know, there's this increasing number. These slumber parties, where they sell sex toys
within wards.
Well, it's still looked down on, but it's gaining more.
Yeah. It's looked down on, but it's sort of cute.
It's like, oh, good, they're discovering now, some of their sexuality.
The young married man goes off into the sex toy shop and buys a sleeve and takes it home and put. That's so what I want to point out right now is there is a dichotomy of male versus female sexuality, even culturally. The male sexuality is seen as perverse and dirty.
Gross.
Something we need to tame.
Right.
Icky.
At least kind of sticky and messy.
Well, it can be that.
Well, that's the problem, is it's sticky and messy.
I don't think that is the problem.
But no, it's seen that way. Like those adjectives are oftentimes used, you know, that with male sexuality. In terms of male sexuality, you need to wash afterwards, right? Like when you hear about all these women that having their 50 Shades of Grey book, you don't oftentimes hear this thing saying, I touched her book and then I need to go and wash my hands. And I'm just saying that male sexuality.
Yeah, if you pick up a pornographic magazine that you know someone has looked at, you're like, ew, gross.
Right. Male sexuality is seen as dirty and seen as disgusting. And seen as something, and this is generally culturally in our culture, not across the world, definitely not historically.
Animalistic. Uncontrollable.
Mm-hmm. And these things spill out in the church, and if you look at, especially the way the youth are treated, that women are taught from very, very young, starting at 12 in our church.
Younger.
That they are the gatekeepers and controllers of male sexuality, and male sexuality just has to be stopped, chained up, and put down.
And we need to always be on our guard. And not trust men when it comes to sexuality.
Yeah, you don't trust men.
And that trust, not to put too, is men are in the Mormon church are not to be trusted around children. They're not to be trusted around married women. They're not to be trusted around single women.
Or teenagers.
Men
or
are treated...
Or by themselves.
Or by themselves.
Or by
in
themselves.
The
and they are not
in
to
front
trust
of a computer.
Themselves either.
Right.
Like, it's not just that you don't trust others. It's that you don't trust yourself. You could be a raving maniac at any moment.
Mm-hmm.
Wear as many layer of clothing as possible. So it's harder to get to.
Yeah.
And it, I mean it. Your penis.
Oh.
The thing between their legs. But and it's so bad that even young children, like 6-7-year-olds, are taught to cover up their shoulders. Like, men will be turned on by a 7-year-old girl's shoulders. And they couldn't control themselves against that.
I wonder if we extend that far, or if we instead, being batshit crazy Mormons, if we instead are not just trying to set a precedence. Because do we really think that middle-aged men are going to get turned on by a 6-year-old?
Do we let men alone in the primary?
Yeah, I think people are afraid
that we let men in the nursery.
We only, you know, we point out in the feminist discussion, we do allow men to be alone with women in a sexual situation when they're acting, but in only a very, very tightly controlled.
Wait, when can they be alone with women in a sexual situation?
Bishops can take a 13-year-old girl, close the door, and ask her if she masturbates.
Right, but they're in the authority position that is completely
non-sexual. This goes to where we start. There are only like two people in the entire stake who are allowed to do that, the bishop and the
state
president.
That's what the priesthood does. That's what we were talking about at the very beginning, that men need it because they're somehow... you know, defunct.
Reprobate.
Right.
Yeah. The priesthood fixes that.
Exactly.
Right. So when
but
you have the mantle,
but you're not
of the
exercising
priesthood.
Your priesthood in the nursery.
Right.
Because the nursery is a woman's job for children. So.
Right.
Yeah. But when you have the mantle of the priesthood, you're sort of like guarded from having sexual desires toward the 13-year-old who's telling you that she masturbates.
Well, I think that it's actually not. So I want to say that contextually, that's just not even on the table. And that's actually one of the problems that Mormons have is that when it comes up that happened, so when recently the guy got arrested for allegedly exposing himself and touching the little girl, and he's a high council member, sitting high council member, well, I guess he got released by now, and he's an employee of the church. We don't have the ability to consider that situation. It's contextually off the table, mm-hmm. and when it comes up, it's a total anomaly that has to be dealt with. But we can't think about that ahead of time. So it's just not a question that we ask ourselves. What if the bishop is getting turned on by the cute 15-year-old that he's talking to about?
It's not on the table.
But
what
you're talking about, you're saying that the modesty thing with a 4-year-old in primary sets a precedence to prepare her to wear gowns. I mean, it's preparing her to be afraid of men. Men, either way, it's saying someday some man is going to come after you, mm-hmm. or
if
you're
you
going to make him lose his virtue.
You know, and it's preparing her not only to be afraid of men, it's in one context to be afraid of men, but in another context to condescend to men, to control them, and to consider herself to be, like we said, the gatekeeper. So there's either, it's one or the other. She's either going to be afraid of him in his, Mr. Hyde state, or she's going to be controlling of him and condescending to him in his Dr. Jekyll state. And that defines the relationship that Mormon women have with men.
Well, because men in our religion are very simplistic in that way. When we look at it, you know, sexually, they're either really good or really bad, and they can't be in between.
Right.
But so you don't know which ones are going to... But except you do trust the bishop, and you do trust the state president.
But the bishop and the state president, I mean, the fact that you're using those words, I want to be clear to wrap up our earlier discussion, is maleness, even though priesthood is only bestowed upon the male, they're two separate things in the culture. They're two separate things in the religion. Being a man and being a priesthood holder are very different.
Mm-hmm.
So we allow the bishop and the stake president stuff to do things we just do not allow men to, because mm-hmm. these guys are set apart and holy in this particular role. So you're not thinking about the bishop as a man, you're thinking about him as the bishop.
It's a role.
Right. Because men are corrupt and not to be trusted at all the way across the board. They'll joke in the church about men can't be in charge of the Thursday potluck or the Friday potluck. Men can't be in charge of the ward camp out. Men can't be in charge of anything. Priesthood can be, but men cannot. Men
are, can be in charge of the whole church.
Men are incompetent.
Well, you know, this reminds me of my dad. So my dad is a sweet guy, and he's always been, you know, really faithful in the church, really active, done his duty, everything. But when I was a young teenager, when I was just going through puberty, he stopped touching me. He stopped being affectionate. He stopped letting me, you know, before I would sit on his lap, I couldn't sit on his lap at all anymore because he didn't want to give any appearance of anything. And he was probably also afraid of himself. Like, not that he would ever do anything and never did anything, but just, and that hurt me because I didn't understand it. I didn't understand why all of a sudden.
You mean he didn't sit you down for 45 minutes and have a chat about that either and
no.
clearly communicate that?
Well, no. I think, I know for me personally, that was an issue. I didn't date a lot or before my mission and stuff. I was, you were taught to think that you yourself were an animal. And unfortunately, what it does is it puts women in this gilded cage, where women are elevated so much the way the men talk about them that they do not see them as peers. And I always saw myself, and I've talked to plenty of others, as completely inferior to women in many ways. They were more emotionally mature. They were more spiritual. And it took me a long time to overcome that and be able to have normal relationships with women. And I think a lot of men can turn that around in a very negative way to a sort of hatred, just the way that a lot of people like hate the government, you know, and hate the leaders because they don't like people who appear in a power position over them. And I would argue that not the priesthood. I mean, take the priesthood out of the culture. Women are in a power position over men. I want to dig into that a little bit. The way we so pathologize sex and have such an unhealthy relationship about it with the church. In any relationship, whoever needs the relationship the least has the most power. There's an old phrase that say, whoever loves least wins. When you're in a relationship, a romantic relationship or otherwise, whoever loves the least is always in charge, is always calling the shots.
I mean, this is business negotiation 101
absolutely.
But people don't like to think of it in terms of their own relationship.
So it's an economical exchange, even if it's not, like, it is an economical exchange no matter what, even if we don't like to think about it that way, and even if it doesn't involve money, it's
right.
just an exchange of utility.
Conversation is.
Ways.
You know, the person who's right. least interested in the conversation might be checking their cell phone or looking around. They control where the conversation is going to go. Whoever wants the conversation more is not in the position of power. So what we've done is we've created this really perverse thing in the church where we've trained women to suppress their sexuality and to control it. And we've trained men to think about themselves in terms of their dogs begging for bones. And unfortunately, because of the other power dynamic, the power dynamic of the patriarchy and the man is in charge, this gets perverted by a lot of both men and women into the way that women gain power in their own relationship.
With sex.
Because they can use it against him, and he's going to fall into that paradigm because he's been taught that even to want sex from his wife is dirty,
mm-hmm.
because sex is dirty, and he's dirty for wanting it. And rather than having a normal, like, two normal, healthy, romantic people want to get together physically, now there's going to be a...
Or even to be able to talk about it in a sort of more rational way.
Oh, yeah, you can't even instead, go and say, you know, dear... How's your headache tonight?
Yeah, because that's exactly right. You have to mince around it, right?
Right.
Because the stakes are also high. Okay, so there's no disclaimer I can make here that would be appropriate. But anyway, the stakes are
high. I have to let the audience know that Greg's wife is
in the room.
So he's double trimming
Let's
back.
Think about this for a moment. Anyway, the stakes are high. But the way you have to handle yourself in that negotiation is also, like, if you have any ounce of consideration, you also have to be deferential at the same time presenting your needs or what, you know, and it just becomes an impossible
really
quandary.
Like, nobody needs sex in the context of Mormonism.
Yeah, from the church's point of view.
Sex.
Yeah.
So we're talking about husbands asking for permission to have sex with their wives, basically.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
And there's, and if it's the other way around, women asking for sex from their husbands, that's generally considered what?
unusual.
I would guess just off the cuff, 10 to 30% of couples, I mean, there's always going to be a sexual dynamic where one person wants more sex than the other. And I would guess in 10 to 30% of the couples, it's the woman, but you know, in 70 to 90%, it's the man. And that, of course, even changes.
Sure.
By the day, actually, but generally over the course of how young children are and how the couple's getting along and their age and all sorts of things. But and that's just normal relationship dynamic. There's always a negotiation that has to go along. But the church and what it's taught us about sex and our own identity and the women thinking they're these holy protectors of morality and virtue is something that can be taken away from a woman, or something that she gives a man as he deserves it, and men don't have any virtue. I mean, that's if you look at the young women's values, the young men don't have the values because men don't have any of those virtues. They're not modest. They're not moral.
It would almost be
Isn't
better.
Is a scout virtuous? Is a scout not virtuous?
Yes, a scout is virtuous, lovely, and good. No.
But I'm serious.
We don't internalize the values the same way,
right?
In terms of that all men are disgusting pigs. You know.
No, that's that's.
And how do you measure a man's virginity? Mm. I mean. When we talk about this virginity obsession,
not with the ruler, that's for sure.
Well, maybe you don't.
But it would be the same. It should be the same standard for men and women.
Right.
It should be something that can be.
But
the
a
same
man
for
gets
men and
to
women.
Take a woman's virtue. So we're talking about permission mm-hmm. here. A man takes a woman's virginity, and of course, a woman can. I think we're getting off course. We can edit this out.
No. I think it's because that's a paradigm. I think your point is it's a social construction.
Right.
Right. There's an exchange, and in reality, there's not even a line where you can say where somebody's a virgin, somebody's not. It's completely a social construction.
Well, you can sew up a woman's hymen again,
but not all women have hymens. And some
true,
women, you know. So
you can say once a penis fully enters the vagina.
What about soaking? Come on.
That counts.
Well, that's a BYU.
If you put your penis in the vagina, then you're not a virgin.
But my point is it's a social construction. It's not a physical construction.
Well,
and it's one that we bear on the weight of bear on the shoulders of the women, that they are to protect their own virtue.
But
we'll talk about men taking virtue. I mean, it's not like all like men are come off. And I would say that men might even come off in terms of church discipline worse off than women do. In Miracle Forgiveness, Kimball makes that point. Since men are taking virtue away from women, men are doing something worse. And like, if a woman becomes pregnant, that's all to the damnation of the man. Like, you know, he makes that point very clearly. So I don't want listeners who aren't familiar with Mormon culture to think that a man has a sexual past that a woman doesn't. That is not true at all.
No, that's not true at all.
But in Mormon culture, it is a virtue, speaking of virtue, to not desire sex, or to be able to completely control your desires for sex.
Right.
Putting off the natural man.
And in Mormon culture, I would say to that point, and also to the point about Kimball, it is frequently possible for a woman to sort of skirt by under the radar with her libido without having a whole lot of in-your-face confrontation about it, because a lot of the times the bishop is not going to ask, do you masturbate?
That's true.
And mm-hmm. and the boys are not usually going to have that possibility.
Well, I think
again,
that's
who
true.
Who gets the porn rhetoric? Who gets the masturbation
right,
rhetoric?
Right, the porn rhetoric is all over the place, and we don't have the Twilight or the 50 Shades of Grey rhetoric
right.
in even remotely the same. It doesn't even exist.
It occurs, but it's not. I mean, for men and boys, I mean, they're hammering on that just incessantly.
Women are taught how they can go about controlling men's sexuality.
Yes.
And men are taught how they must control.
And
their
I've heard
sexuality.
Story after story of Relief Society lesson where they're taught to go through their internet caches and to watch over their husband.
I've been in one of those lessons.
And the thing is, it instills this fundamental distrust to the point of this podcast of men.
Absolutely,
it damages the relationship.
The things, like you think about like what I said about my dad. You think about seeing a teenage daughter sit on her father's lap, and there will be plenty of people who will be looking at that thinking, you know, that might not be healthy. That's sort of sick.
Yeah.
Or like kissing your teenage daughter goodnight or something like that. Or when, after you and I were married, my dad started giving his kids kisses on the cheek when we were going home. We always give a hug before we leave, and then he would give a kiss on the cheek. And one of the first times that he did that, I wasn't expecting it, so I sort of turned my head, and he got me on, like, the side of my mouth. And my mom said, "Did you just kiss her on her mouth?" And I was like, come on, he was trying to give me a kiss on the cheek. But it was like this complete distrust that men are just animals and that they will just try to get sex wherever they can get it.
That story kind of makes me want to cry.
Yeah.
Because the idea that your dad was trying to do something sweet, not prurient in any way.
Well, and the fact, it speaks this whole thing, that she had been around him for years and years and years and years, that he's a man who'd served in callings in the church. He demonstrated fidelity to the church, fidelity to his wife, fidelity to his family.
And he had probably changed your diapers and seen you bathe as a child.
Yes.
And the trust.
But the idea that my mom would even say that or think that.
Well, that's what I'm saying when I'm saying that men are taught to be emotionally illiterate. I mean, it's, we cripple men emotionally in these ways. We don't even allow them healthy outlets to interact with women unless it's in a sexual way. And we've talked about this before when we talked about being friends, men and women being friends. Men and women can interact in a lot of ways in the church, but there's usually all these safeguards put in place because it implies that men and women are only there for procreation. So you can't have men and women working together on a project without other men and women there because they can't be left alone because they'll have sex. Never mind if one is gay or not. Because in the church, men and women are only there to procreate at the end of the day.
Right.
So it all kind of comes down to sex. I mean, I hate to say that.
Adam and Eve is actually gay, so that wouldn't even be like a safe
moment. Those people don't exist.
Moment, right.
Unless they've been masturbating too much.
But masturbation,
we all should be gay,
is, I think, a huge source of psychological damage to especially our young men in the church.
What?
That it's something that they try to control, but usually is not something that they can control.
It bucks the system. If we control men through sexuality, and part of that is telling men that they're animals, and a lot of people coming out of the church know that they were afraid to leave the church because they didn't know what they would do. You'll hear this, if it wasn't for the church, I'd be who knows where I'd be
in
some opium den, like surrounded by nine hookers, and it's just like because
that sounds like a party to me.
Like everybody else in my neighborhood who's not a member of the church, that's totally the way they are.
Oh, that's what they're doing.
But masturbation is frowned upon. But you mentioned homosexuality, and I mean, I famously argue with people the church will never allow homosexuality, and one of the reasons is, once again, it cuts out completely the control mechanism the church has, because it destroys the way the church controls men. Men are controlled through their sexuality. Men are controlled through their access to females. And through definitions of masculinity and what's right and what's wrong. And if you allow for a system, it completely undercuts the culture of control.
Well, that's why homophobia is misogynistic, right? Any man that acts like a woman, we can't have. And I was thinking about this, I spent some time with some really great Mormon men yesterday, but the homophobic, racist, sexist, fat jokes were just flown around like they do when you're with people. And I hate to make the blanket statement that that those kind of things are acceptable amongst all Mormon men, but fat jokes, very acceptable. Homophobic jokes, pretty acceptable. Sexist jokes, pretty acceptable. And I was thinking about that when we talk about patriarchy. It values dominance, right?
Yep.
And a believer would say, we don't dominate, we talk about benevolent patriarchy. My bishop would never act that way. But having authority is about dominance. And when you value dominance, every oppressed group underneath you is going to be at risk. A fair game. So homosexuals, because they don't fit into your paradigm, fat people, disabled people, women.
People.
So if you're a man and you fit into any of those categories, you're going to be fair game to be made fun of. And I think that that's why, the patriarchy actually kind of fuels bullying. That's kind of like a really
absolutely,
bold statement.
Yeah.
Well, this is like, no, because you're describing like silverbacks. I mean, you're describing other primate cultures. We are primates. You're describing other primate cultures of which we have similarities.
And if you watch the simians where there is the silverback, where usually that dude will sit quietly until he needs to move, and then he'll move with extreme prejudice.
Yeah.
And all the other monkeys that are vying for power are constantly causing problems, right? but the silverback doesn't. So you can look and say, look at how well this system works. The silverback is just sitting there gently. But he's the one at the top of the heap, right? And he only moves when he needs to move, when he needs to defend his power or he feels like the structure is going to undermine. But it breeds this other culture of aggression and of vying for position and of, and since you're forming yourselves into hierarchies, yeah, you want to make sure the fatties are down or who, whatever group, you know.
Or violence or, like you said, aggression. I mean, how do men assert their dominance? How do men prove that they're men in the church? It's acceptable for men to be more violent. If violence is acted against a little boy, you know, like he says, oh, he hits me. We diminish it. We say, oh, suck it up. Tough, you know, suck it up. You're a man. But if someone hit a little girl, we would all be horrified, right? Because men have to use violence to assert their dominance. That's one way that, you know, if you were to line your ward up, all the people, some men are going to be physically strong and some are going to be weak, but the skinny, bony guy is supposed to act in the exact same way as the beefy guy. It doesn't matter how he's built. Because he's a man, he's supposed to act that way, and I think that puts a lot of unfair pressures.
And I do want to draw a distinction. I think we have these elements in our DNA, but I think we are not great apes. We've evolved on a different plane, and this is not necessary. So one thing I want to make sure it's clear is we have these elements with us, but this culture we have is what's fueling this sort of thing. And there are plenty of men and women in this world today who can live in more egalitarian systems. So it's not like men are inherently patriarchal and will thus exhibit all of the negative symptoms of a patriarchy. It's that we have a patriarchal system which plays both men and women into those roles. So I don't want it to be like, well, doomed to this structure.
No, we could argue like gender binary, which means that men are a certain way and women are a certain way all night. But, I mean, in the church, we adhere to a gender binary.
And we select for those people. Like you're saying, that's the homosexuality issue. We're not going to allow men who display effeminate characteristics to rise to power because that undermines
the structure.
That's why
they don't exist in the patriarchy.
Actually,
there's no room for that.
How do you explain
Richard Scott,
then? I
argue with you guys, yeah. Because I think in Mormonism, in particular, as opposed to some other patriarchal, you know, structures or societies, some of those feminine qualities are really prized. Like you want to be men who are sensitive to the arts, sensitive to women, sensitive to children, who are, you know, like open and gregarious, and they are prized and they get promoted.
I'll disagree. They do not get promoted. They're prized at the top. How did Hitler? The podcast almost over.
They do get promoted.
How did Hitler do the Nazi salute? He did it half ass, right? Like everybody's got their arm up in the air, giving this salute, and they're all completely. The angle is all set exactly right. Not Hitler. He was like, you know, because, and if you go into a company, you oftentimes find the people at the bottom, the workers, do not necessarily adhere to the dress code. The people at the top do not adhere to the dress code. The people in the middle do. So once you get people at the top, they will display characteristics that show, I am not a big patriarchal guy. This is why the leaders weep, because the leaders weep
but
to show.
But that bleeds down all the way down.
It doesn't.
And yes, it does.
You are systematic. You look at the 12 and you say, oh, these guys are open, but you look at their CVs. You look at the way they rose through the church. You look at their degrees. These guys are lawyers. They're businessmen.
But I'm saying the trappings of that. I'm not saying that these are authentically open and sensitive people. I'm saying that you're supposed to put on that persona.
Well, I would suggest another explanation for that, though, because I actually agree with both of you in a way. But I think, okay, so society values masculine, feminine traits. Church compounds it. But then we add additional traits that a man should be. He wears a white shirt, he wears a tie, he can cry over his testimony.
Well, like Jesus was meek and mild and humble.
But Jesus had a beard.
At least allegedly.
Right.
We don't allow
Jesus
beards.
Jesus had a beard, so that
and a cat of nine tails, right?
But Jesus is presented as a very compassionate, feminine, almost feminine man.
Yeah, we've absolutely feminized Jesus.
Jesus is hard because Jesus is just the id.
But
he's represented
whatever
you want
now.
Jesus is
whatever
you want him to be. And violent and masculine and tough. That's not the Mormon man. And that's why I think a lot of times there's these gay sites for you know that there's men in garments because there is there is this sort of thing with Mormon men that but, those characteristics.
But which Mormon men? If you go into a ward,
desirable
27-year-old men do not get up. You know, like 30-year-old men, the men who are vying for the power positions are not getting up, being all weepy. It's the men who have achieved those power positions,
and the teenagers and young adults who are trying to find a spouse.
Well, those are the kind of men that
women in the church are looking for: spiritual, compassionate, good with children.
I will say this: I've never seen a stereotypical gay. I want to be sensitive. Flamboyant man. Bear his testimony, and as a bishop, if a bishop is gay,
well, not gay,
he knows how to act, so he suppresses any of those things that would be seen as homosexual, because those are still not acceptable in the church.
But I'm saying, so you've got the Arnold Schwarzenegger, or Van Damme, or the guy that was
any of the Rambo, really,
yeah,
that is not the kind of masculinity that Mormon men are
absolutely
supposed to
embrace. I agree with
no
that.
We're the MBA type of masculinity, yeah, preferably, yeah. I want to say I'm listening to this and thinking we may be worrying about boxing Mormon men into wherever they're at too much. I mean, I don't know why it was, but I developed an art form of crying during testimonies mm-hmm. that I didn't ever realize until I was sitting in here on my first podcast, realizing that about a year ago that I couldn't not cry, and I was really pissed about it. But
there were some triggers that would
that there were things that I just naturally did. I felt like they were really sincere, but they really pissed me off once I'd gone through a faith crisis. But so we're talking about sort of the way Mormon men are, and I agree that there is some validity to that, but we might be worrying ourselves a little overly by trying to nail that down.
And it's a cultural element. I mean, the church in Payson is a little bit different than the church in Roanoke.
For sure.
You know, and there are elements of that. But I think to the general point that there is, oftentimes for men, to kind of wrap up this discussion we had the last few minutes, I want to go back a little bit to an example we talked about before. When Mormons go on missions, you know, the men have a very tight role they have to play. And the women, it's not as tight. So the men all have to dress exactly the same way. Women are allowed to wear their hair differently and to wear different clothing and to express individuality.
Hey, you got the ties. You wear cool ties.
You would be surprised if we did a general call for mission rules around ties. You'd be surprised probably how many hundreds of rules
really?
We could come up about. I think in my thing, it had a top and lower tolerance on the number of inches wide your tie
goodness.
Could be. And there are things on colors. I think my first mission manual, you weren't allowed to have paisley on your tie. The point is there's these really rigid areas of control that oftentimes come on men, not as strongly on women. Because women aren't vying for those power positions, there's much more room for a role for individual identity than for men.
Yeah,
I bring that up because we talk about these scripts that men have to play, and we were arguing about the edges of them, which are all valid arguments. But I think the idea that the fundamental idea, which I want to reemphasize, the fact that men are broken and that men are the natural, they're the enemy to God, and they are evil and the source of evil in this world. And it's only by following these patterns and by strictly doing these things and keeping all this other stuff in control. And the normal, nominal masculine, I think is seen as something that's fundamentally flawed. And the normal, and the normal, nominal feminine, I think is something that's seen, it's idealized, but then tightly controlled
weak.
Too. So to go to where we started in the beginning, the church wants good cogs, right? And it does so in part by breaking down that individual and not allowing the full actualization of the feminine or the masculine, and especially keeping the relationship between the two from conjoining in a healthy way.
I have to say something. You okay. Finger in hand. Okay. You said that males are the source of evil in this world.
Yes.
But I also think it's important to point out that...
You're not going
to
bring up Eve, are you? Because that's the weak spot in my argument.
No. I was going to bring up the fact that...
Well, he submitted to her, so...
In the eternal perspective of things, men are the only ones who can reach the highest sort of state of glory, right? To become a god.
But
it's the men who are the gods. And you look at Jesus and you look at Lucifer, they're both males. So the ultimate righteousness and the ultimate evil are male characters, and they can only be male characters.
You're absolutely right. But, I mean, to go to the point I was making before, it's not men who become gods. It's very few men. It's in the book of Abraham.
It's not women.
And it's not
women who become Satan.
No, that's what I was saying before. They sit the whole battle between good and evil out on the side. And Abraham...
Yeah, we're just watching it from the sidelines.
Abraham learns from God that all men can be ordered. I mean, it says that right in the scriptures. They can all be ranked, and there's one right above the other. And that men are in this grand hierarchy that the women are not put into. Mm-hmm. And we can talk another hour about social and corporate structures and all that kind of stuff and the value between, and this is, a lot of this is in feminist theory, right? Feminist theory gets a lot into corporate structuring and how we organize ourselves into hierarchies. And I think the church has bought into that. And hierarchies are great when you're in the top of the hierarchy, and they're piss poor when you're in the bottom of the hierarchy. And I would say that most men are in the church are in this middle vying for scraps. Mm-hmm. And I think we tend to, when we talk about feminist theory or patriarchy, we tend to focus on these few and forget where most of the men are, and they're not really that much better off than the women. In some ways, they're worse off.
I just keep thinking of Greg's mission experience that he talked about at the beginning. Like, he was by textbook more Christ-like before he went on his mission, right? More accepting, loving, didn't really let it bother him. And then he gets correlated on his mission. He gets through the system, pumps out. He comes out looking and acting the part of someone in the Mormon hierarchy, which is exactly what they want. We, for some reason, in the last, I don't know, 50 years, 60 years, we've probably had this obsession with pumping out this idealized Mormon man. He looks the same way. He acts the same way. He talks the same way. Even on
missions. And he thinks the same way.
I'm sorry?
And he thinks the same
way. And he thinks the same way.
Yeah, exactly.
And so... That's how I see the church harming men the most. If you do not fit into that script that they pump out, then you're out of luck.
I think when we talk about the ways that the church harms men the most, I think we have to go back to sexuality and the vilification of sexuality and the vilification of something that is inherent, is part of being a healthy and happy human being, is having a healthy and happy sex life. And the church kills that at every opportunity. The church gets it wrong in every place. So even to the point where the church is happy to demonize the mechanisms of male arousal and completely ignore the existence of female arousal. So every single priesthood session in General Conference, we're going to get beat over the head about the fact that we like boobs. And women are never going to get beat up on because we just have to pretend that they don't care. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, I read a book recently called A Billion Wicked Thoughts, which does a study of internet searches, the kind of porn that people are searching for. And the book is not written about Mormonism at all, has nothing to do with Mormonism, but it uses as the prime case of female porn, Twilight, which is written by a
Mormon,
which was available in Deseret Book for a long time, and most Mormon girls have it. And you're right, it's this willful ignorance of female sexuality and this overreaction to male sexuality.
I remember because this is a conversation that I'm having, like, here on this podcast and on the Expositor podcast and everything, I'm going to be, like, opening up the trench coat a little overly. But I remember as I was struggling through, like, trying to figure out sexuality, young married to, say, a few years ago, I'm like, man, none of this stuff makes sense. And I'm thinking about the concept of porn and pornography. It's such an ugly, awful word. It means so many things. It's so icky and nasty and everything. Really, what does it mean? It means that you like to see naked people. Like, and the idea that you sort of got to that and that is so, wicked or depraved becomes laughable at the point that you realize how silly that is. Like, well, of course I want to look at naked people. Like, we're made that way.
Monkeys like to look, watch other monkeys having sex.
Well, everybody, I mean, it's not even, I mean, cause so much.
So we are animals.
I guess I only have my personal porn experience versus, you know, cause I'm not really into like stomp videos or anything, but like, you know, for the most part, it's like guys like Victoria's Secret or guys like Sports Illustrated, guys like Playboy, guys like this stuff that is, and well, that's not fair. I guess the point is you get to the point where you, if you take away the word, if you take away the naughty word, you go, this is so dumb. Like, how could this be the most harmful, evil thing that would take over anything?
And I
like
think
they're just boobs.
The answer is, it's just...
They're not that great.
It's just men,
well,
right?
That's,
I mean, that's what it goes back to. It's male sexuality. That's why the word porn, I mean, it's an excellent point. The word is meaningless. It means nothing. People are arguing about porn all the time, but there's actually more difference in the genre of porn than there is in all of like non-pornographic films. I mean, it's a huge amount, array, and we don't need to go in and define all those, but we don't actually know anything about that. But it's sort of like people saying, do you like cinema? And you say, what are you talking about? What genre? Oh, all of it. Well, no. You know, it's like, you know, but we say, oh, men like porn and women need to stop men from looking at porn and stuff. It's just, and it goes this whole thing. We're not looking at the nuances of who we are and what we stand for. So,
well, and we're categorically telling men that they are wrong for being in that instance. That's one of those places where I want to say, you know what, we have to figure out a way to stop telling people you're just wrong for being what you are.
Bro, and that's what
it's a tricky thing.
Absolutely. Now, I think that what's the solution to this problem, the feminist problem? Well, allow individuals. Define masculinity to sex or masculinity to femininity on a spectrum. And I hate saying that because that puts it on two dimensions, like it's on a line. It's actually three-dimensional. It can go in every direction. Allow people to be individuals. Allow relationships to grow naturally and allow them to sort of work them out. I think the church will become more healthy when it allows human beings to be human beings and stop categorizing and sex stereotyping and that sort of stuff. And that's the problem. And of course, the church has to give up its control mechanisms. It has to give up the way it controls women to keeping them in the home, keep them out of the workplace, keeping them competing for men. It has to stop pathologizing, you know, some standard male behaviors and talking about men as if they're all retarded monkeys. You know, it has to allow people to be what people are with, and then deal with the flaws and problems from there. I think that's the solution. All right.
Well, there we go. That was tidy.
Well, as always, the discussion continues on the website at MormonExpression.com. You can check it out there for things like our upcoming events. There are community contacts if you want to meet other people in your area who share your similar worldview or just want to get a beer and complain about the church. We also have references to other things going on. The Feminist Mormon Housewife podcast is under the URL feministmormonhousewifepodcast.org.
.org.
Yep. And you can go to, is it fmh.org? We'll take you to the blog.
feministmormonhousewives.org.
.org.
Without the podcast.
Yeah. You can see what's going on over there too. I'm sure you guys link back and forth between the two.
We are working on it.
I've got to do things on my list from 18 months ago. So, and then the Mormon Expositor.
MormonExpositor.com. I think, and .org and .gov and probably a bunch of other dots. we managed to get several of them, but let's just go to MormonExpositor.com.
And that will work.
And of course, Mormon Expression Voices still comes out every other week as it always has. And
if you're a Spanish speaker or know someone who is, there's more, Pesquisas Mormonas.
Yeah, you can check that out. And of course, then you can hear Zilpha and I weekly over at the Reasonability Podcast at reasonabilitypodcast.com. All right, yeah. Thanks everybody.
Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.